This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for coming along. We're on Twitter at KUOW. What fictional character would you most like to spend Christmas with? For me, I have to go to the TV show Glee. I would love to tinsel my tree with Sue Sylvester.
I know you think I'm heartless, Will, and you may have a point. I spend large segments of each day picturing you choking on food. And I recently contacted an exotic animal dealer because I had a very satisfying dream that the two of us went to a zoo and I shoved your face into one of those pink inflamed monkey butts.
That is good company. Better yet, what if you could sing Christmas carols with Sue Sylvester and Meredith from The Office?
Meredith, your boob is out.
Fine.
No.
Too far.
Damn it, Meredith.
Casual day.
Okay, sadly, Sue and Meredith don't exist, but the actors, Jane Lynch and Kate Flannery, are here right now. They're singing two shows tonight at the Triple Door. Jane and Kate, welcome to Seattle.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for playing that classy clip.
It really is classy. Yeah, yeah. You get to live with that.
I do. It's okay. I can live with it. I'm good.
You can handle it. Well, the show's called A Swingin' Little Christmas. Here's a flavor of that.
We're having a swingin' little party with all of our friends. We're hoping you dig the
sort of boogie woogie bugle meets yes. Ring a ding ding.
There you go. I like that.
Yeah,
that's very good. That Tim Davis, who sings with us, arranged that baby.
That was your three part harmony.
Yeah,
that was Glee. He arranged on Glee.
Yeah, he arranged everything you hear on Glee. He arranged all the vocals.
And he's exhausted now. There's so many songs on that show.
Songs.
Still
yes.
working on. No.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it all Christmas music?
It's all
tonight.
Christmas yeah. music. It's from our album of the same name, Swingin' Little Christmas.
Available on Amazon and iTunes.
And iTunes.
I'm always plugging. I'm sorry.
Indeed. And also, we're going to be signing albums after the show if you want to stop by and throw $20 our way or whatever you got. It doesn't matter. We're giving them out too.
Even if they don't want an album, just give money to Jane
just
Lynch.
Just give me $20.
Yes, yes.
Please.
You know, if you had asked me to guess how the two of you met, I would have probably said, probably doing small theater in Chicago, like a live stage version of the Brady Bunch where Jane Lynch plays Carol Brady.
Right?
That's exactly how we met.
No, that's impossible.
That's crazy.
And Kate,
but you played Alice in my imaginings, and
yes.
that's how it happened?
Oh my, that's actually how it happened,
that's
Bill.
That's crazy.
Do you remember how you met?
Very first time I ever went to Second City, Jane was understudying for Bonnie Hunt.
Oh,
it was the day Bonnie Hunt got married, so she came back.
Bonnie Hunt from One Day at a Time.
No, that's Bonnie Franklin.
Sorry,
Bonnie Hunt was in... she was in
the Bonnie Hunt Show.
Bonnie Hunt Show,
yeah.
But she played Robin Williams' wife in Jumanji. She's been in a million movies.
Yeah, she's been in a million
Hunt.
Television
yes. Jerry,
shows.
Jerry
she's
McGuire.
Really talented, she's a really great sketch
yeah.
artist. And I was
yes.
her, I was her understudy.
But yes. how did that turn into harmonizing?
Good question.
Fate. I don't know.
Fate, yeah.
Just luck.
I'm the luckiest. I don't know.
Well, which is it? Which of you is lucky?
I think we're lucky together. I think.
Yeah, maybe. This has been such a fortuitous, wonderful journey, and you know. And so many people who do TV, they couldn't be bothered with live audiences. I can't get it.
I love
we're having
it.
A great
I, yeah.
time.
Why do some TV people not want to deal with live audiences?
Well, I don't know that. We were brought up in the theater.
Well, yeah.
That's we earned our stripes and where we met, you know, when we were in Chicago. We did the Brady Bunch together. We were also in the same circle of friends, so we were always doing sketch comedy stuff together. That's how we came to television was via
right.
sketch comedy on stage.
Right.
Right.
I suppose live theater, people are... What cell phones are going off, or you'd have to deal with the questions over and over. TV is a little safer for some people.
Yes, yes, it's more controlled, and someone
exactly.
else is kind of editing. I mean, it's not, you know.
So what's wrong with you that you love to be in the messy?
We love that the ephemeral. We like when things happen, and if they're not great, they just go away.
Yeah.
But the sad part of that is if it's really great, it still goes away.
It also goes
That's
away.
Right.
It also goes away. I love the immediacy of being on stage. I love
yes.
that the audience is, you know, 50% of the experience.
Yeah, and they're like your GPS. If you're not going in the right place, they will let you know.
Yeah. Yes.
You got to turn the car around,
right,
baby.
Exactly.
This is true. Are there any Christmas carols that you will not sing because they're so awful?
Maybe it's cold outside.
All I want for Christmas is my two front teeth.
Yeah, that's a bad one,
Sorry.
Too.
Funny you should mention Baby It's Cold. That is... Almost unanimous on our Facebook page. That's the one people
don't ever
stand
hear
to
again.
Never hear again,
especially in this climate. Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this is NPR,
what's in this
but
drink?
I have something to
what's
say
in
that's
this
not
drink?
So NPR-ish yeah. about that.
Indeed.
Yeah.
What's in this drink? Just in case you don't remember it, Shanoa wraps it up by saying, "Sorry, listening to someone relentlessly pressuring someone else into sex just doesn't boost my Christmas spirit." There was one defender though. Lala says, "It sounds like two people that really like each other, but the lady might be shy and worried worried about coming out of his house.
Well, that's
the problem.
That's the Dean Martin version.
There's
different versions.
And times they are a-changing.
How did that song, why was that beloved by generations of men and women for?
Well, it does sound like a courting ritual. It's, you know. And,
yeah.
I think they got so exhausted with the same 10 Christmas songs that they just started piling them on in the 50s and 60s. Just that was just like a new one to shake it up.
Exactly.
But A Christmas Carol could be awful and still weirdly fun or campy to jazz up
the way
you guys can do it.
True.
So are you singing, is it kitschy? Are you singing bad Christmas songs?
No,
are you
No. Actually, our music is beautiful. We actually do a version of We Three Kings that is based on Dave Brubeck's Take Five. It's really interesting and fun and cool. But we have some comedy in it too. But,
there's a lot of fun stuff that happens. But musically, it's just really gorgeous, if we do say so ourselves. Tony Guerrero, our band leader, is a wonderful composer and arranger.
And trumpet player. He's
and
amazing.
Trumpet player.
Are you with a quintet tonight?
Yeah,
or with
the Tony Guerrero quintet.
Bass, drum, piano, sax, trumpet.
Sax,
sometimes
trumpet.
Flute.
And sometimes flute. Uh-huh. And then sometimes we have two keyboards going.
Bongo drums. It's exhausting.
Yeah, bongos.
It's fantastic.
Bongos. We have a fun thing.
It's very early 60s, reminiscent of early 60s jazz.
Yeah. And everything is really orchestrated beautifully, and it sounds like a big band. In fact, our album, we used a big band on some of the tunes. We had a string section and a horn section, and it's full and lush.
Can you hear in A Christmas Carol something about the melody that, we could totally harmonize that to be a great ring-a-ding-ding song? Or can you hear A Christmas Carol and go, that song will be boring no matter what anybody ever does with it?
Kate Flannery arranged by herself a version of Good King Wenceslas.
Mm-hmm.
That is the funniest thing and the most... It's kind of like what...
Well, it's based on Louis Prima's Louis Black Prima's. Magic. It's an homage
bump,
to him.
Bump, yes. Bump, bump. Yeah, it's really great. It's got a great beat, and she incorporates O Come All Ye Faithful in it. And yeah, it's pretty amazing. It's really funny.
I actually am a little musical. I play the piano for the Elks initiation in Pasadena, but that's a long story.
Wow.
I can't talk about that anymore.
She's hiding your light under a bushel.
Yes, I know, right?
We got, because I asked, because on our Facebook page, we got some people decrying the boring and the repetitive. Paul McCartney's Wonderful Christmas
Can't
Time came
it.
Up. Listen to this then. Yes. You better take your headphones off.
The party's on.
But I'll sing with it.
The feeling's here.
Wow, wow, wow.
The comes.
Wow, wow, wow.
You picked up on that melody really quickly.
I can't help singing along. That's the hardest thing about being musical, is that you'll end up with stuff in your head you don't like.
Yeah, that's like a...
And you just put that in my head.
Three
you know
horrible
what,
notes
not,
together.
It's Ooh. Not a bad... It's a catchy song, but it's not my favorite, and it's overplayed.
Won't be in the show tonight.
No.
At the Triple Door. This is Jane Lynch and Kate Flannery singing Little Christmas this evening at the Triple Door. What about I guess, treacly. We got some on our Facebook page. Some people shouted out a song. And Nicole says, I'll probably get murdered in the street for this, but I hate the country tune Christmas Shoes. I get the message, and the message isn't bad, but it's so sad that's not what I want.
Me too. I agree.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a flavor.
Sir, I want to buy these shoes for my mama, please. It's Christmas Eve, and these shoes are just her size.
No.
It's like a Facebook share. We don't need to see everything.
They're not even really lyrics. You're right. They're like a share.
It's like, oh, please.
And they're just her size. I could have written those lyrics in my sleep.
Wait, just a little bit more. It's going to get someplace special.
Oh, okay.
Listen to this.
Wanted to look beautiful.
The pain.
If Mama meets Jesus.
Oh, no.
If Mama meets Jesus.
Well, is Mama going to die to meet Jesus?
I think that's what's happening. I don't know the song until just now, but I think
I don't like
it. You could sing it at Christmas or a funeral.
Well,
it's a multi-purpose tune.
We do have a song, I have to say, in our set that I introduced it as saying, you know, not all songs are about hope, light, and love, all Christmas songs. Some of them are sad. They're downright dark and violent.
And that's okay?
And that's
okay.
We got one about a train wreck and a coal mine on Christmas Eve. That's pretty bloody.
Yeah.
But is it tongue-in-cheek? Or are you like... No,
well,
this
let's
is
hope
feel-
so. Yes,
okay.
yes.
It's, yeah, it's written by the folks.
It's written by Christopher Guest,
Michael
Keane, and Harry Shearer.
Yes, you know. Enjoyed you in Mighty Wind.
Thank you. And they sing it in Mighty. It's called Blood on the Coals, and we just added a Christmas element to it.
We're gilding the
Blood
lily
on the
there.
Christmas
That's our
coals.
Only, yeah.
nice. What about... One last thing I want to share from Facebook. Just and we'll talk about other things. But there was some gabbing about the song "Do They Know It's Christmas." Brian is sure it's a god awful '80s group sing garbage band aid. Mm. Do They Know It's Christmas? Lelius loves the song. Flavor.
The party's on.
Oh no!
It's like I Rickrolled Jane Lynch there. I just pranked Kate and Jane. No, actually, it's this. Okay, look, these
it's
poor
so
ladies.
Self-satisfied. This is the thing about this song, that no women have a solo in that version, by the way. It's so 80s. None of the girls have a solo. Like, Bananarama gets to sing with maybe Madonna. It's no bueno.
And
sorry,
it's
guys.
It's also very superior, self-satisfied, and kind of putting themselves up on some kind of
tonight,
pedestal.
Thank God.
For caring.
Here instead of you.
About these poor people.
Okay, to cap that off, obviously the greatest Christmas carol ever is "O Holy Night."
I agree.
Wow.
Really?
I was going to say
"I Do." Actually,
and I'm not Christian, but that song makes me cry all the time.
It's a great song.
When it goes to the fall on your knees.
Fall on your knees. And musically, the song makes you fall on your knees.
It does. It's beautifully modulated. And did you ever hear the Letterman sing it?
No.
The Letterman are from like the 60s.
I know the Letterman.
It's like a four-part.
No relation to David.
No, none. No, and it's just, it'll break your heart.
Yeah. Okay, so that's obvious. Yes. Holy Night. Worst is any
Well, I think the date rape.
Maybe it's cold. Okay. We're kicking that out.
No,
also not in the show tonight at the Triple Door with Jane Lynch and Kate Flannery.
Sorry.
Swing a Little Christmas. You know, I got to ask, and we'll get back to Christmas, but since we're bringing up Baby It's Cold Outside and we have two actors in here, do you mind if I ask you what you think of the so many men in your industry being sexual harassers and abusers? Is that off limits for me to ask you about? Because I'm thinking about it.
No, I mean, I don't think it should happen in any profession. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that this is the first one that seems to be really changing the tide and that there are consequences so far.
What we were saying, too, is that, you know, as Americans, we're either in denial of something or we're absolutely out of our minds about it.
Yeah.
Like right now, there's this panic and...
So you think are you saying we've gone too far?
No, I don't think we've gone too far, but there is kind of this fevered frenzy
there's
that's happening.
There's a knee-jerk, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I think we have to remain reasonable, but we have to shed a light on it as well.
And it is case by case. Not all sexual misconduct is the same as a sexual predator.
But it's all awful.
Yeah.
But
it's
being in Hollywood and TV in Hollywood, all that, is it as widespread as it seems? Is it worse?
I think it is. I think it's widespread. Everybody has a story.
Yeah.
The hashtag Me Too is on fire.
It's true.
Yeah, everybody.
True. And you know, I used to wait tables in Beverly Hills and I would see it I would see the precursor. I'd see the warm up. I mean, it was everywhere.
You could watch it happen.
Yeah.
Well, on NBC, Savannah Guthrie sounded sad because Matt Lauer is a personal friend.
Of course.
Do you have conflicted feelings about obnoxious Hollywood men?
No, there's no. It stinks that they're the gatekeepers.
Yeah.
That's the thing. They've been the gatekeepers. We need to have, that just needs to change.
I think women need to be allowed to step up. And my friend Jill Soloway, who created Transparent, said you don't need to be asked to step up. Just step up and take your place at the table, like she did. You know, she always has. We've known her forever.
Yeah, she created the Real Life Brady Bunch.
She's been.
Oh, is that right?
She's been doing that all of her life. She's been, if she isn't invited to have a seat at the table, she takes one.
Was she involved in outing Jeffrey Tambor?
I don't know. I haven't heard anything about. It's breaking her heart because she loved him.
Finally, on that topic, both of you played women who seemed totally in control. I know it's comedy, but I wonder whether that reflects the real you. Not just about harassment. Just both of you played a comic butt-kicking women. Was that because you're so good at it because you own that, or is that really outside of you're just acting?
Well, I think, I got The Office when I was 40, and I think being having more experience really helped because I think I have had some people pleasing issues in my life and in my career, and it was just great to have something that was so well written, and I feel like part of my personality may have been part of the development of Meredith, because initially when I started the show, Meredith was not a drunk.
Oh, you added that yourself?
I didn't add it, but I think there was something like that we were building together, and just the whole sort of floozy ass. I don't know. I don't know. Or just the absurdity. I think maybe just that anything they asked me to do physically, I would. I'm like, sure, I'll do it. And so I got to do a ton of physical comedy on that show. So many times there'd be a script where I would have maybe one word or one line, and it was fine. I mean, I got it. Luckily, I was smart enough and old enough to not to be counting lines through the script and going, oh, talk enough. You know, it's like actually having the trust that this is actually more powerful in some ways.
I did notice it was harder to find audio of Meredith than it was video.
Yeah. Yeah, luckily we had 9 seasons, so we get a little more of it. Yeah.
Right. And I was telling you before we turned the microphones on that I know someone who was involved in a movie project that you were, and he told me totally separately, Kate Flannery was so fantastic and completely uninhibited. Something about someone in a kilt. I'm not sure exactly what happened.
That movie had a weird,
But you're committed to the bit.
She is show.
You are show.
I always
show.
Say Kate is of show, and that's why I love performing with her. She's always looking to take it to the nth degree.
Well,
I've
had a live comedy act for years, for the last 15 years. It's called The Lampshades. We're like a dying lounge act. So I'm so, and I do it at least once a month. So I'm so used to being on stage in front of an audience and kind of figuring out. And again, like I said, that kind of GPS thing where if you're dying, man, you got to fix it right there.
Yes.
People are
that's
not
going
to wait for you to figure it out.
Is,
right.
Yeah.
It is.
She is. She's
in the moment.
Of keeps another
you
pre- era.
Keeps
in
you
that
present,
way.
You know.
How about you? As Sue Sylvester, Jane Lynch.
Well, you know, I've always been fascinated with people who are cocksure of themselves, and I am not one of those people, but people assume that I am. I'm much more now. I got that role when I was 50. I'm much more sure or just confident than I was when I was a kid, but I've always been fascinated with that, and I was able to bring to it, and so were the writers, and we were kind of on the same page with this, that nobody's that cocksure without protecting something. And we decided, I knew she was protecting some kind of a tender heart, and then they gave me a sister with Down syndrome, and I went, there it is.
Yeah.
That's the piece.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get that in Sue.
Yeah.
Jane Lynch and Kate Flannery here. I want to get back to your show, which is tonight, Triple Door. Two shows, 6:30 and 9:30, mm-hmm. A Swing, A Little Christmas. First of all, just musically, you have another bit that you do, I heard, involving the songs that make us cry as children.
Right, right, right.
And your song was?
Mine was Puff the Magic Dragon.
And right. Jane, that song is so brutal.
Yeah.
To a child,
it is.
I went and tracked down this man who wrote the poem, wrote the lyrics.
Oh, really?
Yeah, his name is Lenny Lipton. He lives in the hills. He lives above L.A., Benedict Canyon or something. And I went and found him, and I said, how could you
do that?
I've heard
us.
You describe it. It wasn't just it's not just sad. Eleanor Rigby is sad.
Right. No, this is Jackie Papers Came No More. And Puff that mighty dragon, he ceased his fearless roar. His head was bent and sour. Oh my God, I can't stand.
Green scales fell like rain.
Puff no longer went to play along the cherry lane without his lifelong friend.
Puff could not be brave. And it was like, I felt as if violence was being, as a kid, I was like
it's
desperately.
It's so good though. And me too. It was such a good cry. It was such a cathartic, the depth of sadness that would come out of it.
That's what Lenny Lipton wants you to think.
Because
he was sort of like, it's cathartic. It's a good cry. You should talk to Jane Lynch.
Yeah,
she
and
basically
it almost felt good. I almost would play it to feel good.
Right.
Sure. Because I felt like, I didn't know this as a kid. You don't process it that intellectually, but it's almost as if your deepest existential fears come up and are released and you're better for it.
God. You said that better than Lenny Lipton. That is basically the same
that.
Deal.
Oh, my God. Like
facing your fear, yeah.
But before I leave Lenny, here's the thing. There was another lyric. The poem kept going.
Ooh. Oh, really?
And another, of course, what does it say? Like kids, grown-ups, they don't last forever, you know.
But not so little boys.
Not so little. Right. Dragons live forever, but not so
dragons
little boys.
Dragons are immortal. They live forever, and little boys grow up and go away.
Okay, so then what happens when one little boy grows up? Here comes another child. It's a little girl.
A
little girl, and she becomes Puff's best friend. And I said, are you kidding me?
Wow.
Why is that not in the song?
Yeah, you got to put that in there.
But then you don't have the Jane Lynch catharsis. I guess. You just tra-la-la, everything's
but
okay.
That's a great ending for that poem because it shows that things come and go, on the earth. And we were talking about this earlier, that we're a sky and there's clouds and clouds come and go, friends come and go. But someone always comes in to take their place and life goes on.
I thought it was. I thought that song was about drugs. I'm so confused. That's what I always heard.
He was telling me, oh, and it's about marijuana. It's not about marijuana. And I said, Lenny, I'm not here to talk about marijuana. You brutalized. We're talking about my pain.
Yes.
Why are we talking about me, Lenny Lipton?
It was brutal. It was a really beautifully brutal poem.
But thank you for doing a bit. I know it's not tonight, but just the idea of singing songs that made us cry as children, I think, is a great idea.
Everybody has one.
Kate?
Yep.
She just said you have one.
Hers was kind of the comic
relief. My dad owned a bar in Philadelphia, and I said this is a song I used to sing that my mother used to sing to me waiting for my father to get home from the bar every night. And then I'd sing them. It was Tour-a-lura. Yeah, but then it would go into Roll Out the Barrel.
See, you would
rendition of Roll Out the Barrel.
You'd put a bow on it.
I did.
You're in the business.
You gave away the joke.
Do you remember Seasons in the Sun?
Oh, Terry Jack. Yeah, absolutely.
That one. He ain't heavy. He's my brother.
Remember that?
That one was just, that was like existential. That was like Eleanor Rigby said, existential.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
And then we even do Ben, the song about the rats.
Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson's about the song about a rat. Ooh,
my lifelong
some
friend.
Dark stuff.
It's all there. Just not tonight. It's a Christmas show. Triple door.
Oh, you're laughing. And
you're going to be laughing. I know I'm not making it sound like it. So let's end on something Christmas. Real tree or fake tree?
I have a fake tree this year.
Bless
tinsel.
You and I have agreed on Puff the Magic Dragon. And what was the other thing?
I forget what we were talking about.
And
sexual harassment.
we're both against it.
We're against it.
We're against it.
Man, can I come on this? Four-part harmony. So fake tree, how is that possible?
It's fantastic. Did you see? It's retro. Did you see the cover of our album? I bought the exact same tree that we bought for that photo shoot.
It's in your home.
Yeah, silver.
Mm-hmm. Kate's giving you side eye.
No. I always have a live wreath so I can smell the Christmas.
That's a good idea.
But then I also have a fake tree.
Uh-huh. Oh, do you?
Faking it. I do.
A fake green tree?
It's green.
Yeah, you should get a retro. She's
but it is
retro,
it is retro, but it's like a Charlie. It's like a, it's
Charlie
not quite
Brown.
Charlie.
It's twiggy.
A little, yeah.
A little twiggy.
Yeah.
Okay.
It has an attitude.
It's like twiggy.
It's like, I'm not full, but I got attitude.
But I know I'm okay.
Jane Lynch, Kate Flannery, singing tonight. Two shows, Triple Door, 6:30 and 9:30. A Swingin' Little Christmas. From what I've heard, Kate will be inappropriate with the audience.
Oh, totally.
And it's going to be big fun.
Hold on, everybody. Yeah. Have a drink. It'll make things
better. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you so much, Bill. Really, thank you guys.
KUOW Seattle, back in just a moment. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in.
America, the country, is as divided as it has been in 150 years since the Civil War.
I think that we are almost in like a civil war at this point.
I don't think we're that far from a civil war in this country right now.
Tucker Carlson, Van Jones, and Rush Limbaugh saying the U.S. seems on the brink of civil war. Well, we certainly seem polarized. A Gallup poll found 77% of Americans think the country is greatly divided. We've seen protests turn violent from Ferguson to Charlottesville. Hate groups are on the rise. But does all of that mean the country could go to war with itself again? Well, let's ask two Civil War experts. Judy Giesberg is a Civil War historian at Villanova University, and David Blight is a professor of history at Yale. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
First, David, you have said it's not inconceivable that a small civil war, small c, small w, or something like it could happen now. What do you mean by that?
Well, a democracy is always capable of civil conflict because we are a democracy. And sometimes republics, if we look back through a few centuries of history, republics have sometimes been more violent than autocracies because dissenting sides are free to dissent, and sometimes dissent can become violent. I don't think we're on the brink of a shooting civil war of a kind, anything like what we remember as the American Civil War, where large armies divide, where it's rooted in the secession of a whole region of the country. Our civil conflict now is limited, it's local, it's ideological, it's racial, it's generational, it's class, and it plays out in a million different kinds of local ways, and then it plays out too in what's happened to our Congress, which is so seemingly profoundly dysfunctional.
Well, then, David, you're describing divisiveness, polarization, and being dysfunctional. But in when you say that a civil war or something like it, are you talking about, do you see violence, like escalated violence in the near future, or not that even?
No, I would not. Historians should never predict, because we don't know what's going to happen necessarily any better than anyone else. And we've gotten so many things wrong, like the end of the Cold War and 9/11 and all the rest. The big fear, I would say, for people to watch for and to look for, is when we do have electoral results, let's say political results, election results, that are truly unacceptable to a large portion of people, to a party, to a group. If we begin to see electoral results that people will not accept, will not live with, then we are probably on the brink of some kind of division, disunion of some kind. Whether that leads to war is a whole other question. But I do think what we should be watching is what is happening to the party system, to the way we organize our politics, which means including holding elections. At what point might we see an election result that just too many people know was rigged, or that they are convinced that a large portion of voters were suppressed, simply wasn't fair? If we reach that point, then we have the risk of disunion. Whether that leads to violence remains to be seen.
Okay, and there's a lot more to say about parties, the party system and its health and rigged elections. Judy Giesberg, Villanova. First, what's your take on this question of whether the U.S. is, as you heard some commentators saying, could be on the brink of some kind of civil war or conflict?
I don't think so, and I have to agree with David. I always like to say that historians like to be the last to know. We don't do predictions, and none of us is comfortable with predictions, and I think we all try to steer clear from them. But I also don't agree that with those commentators that we're on the brink of a civil war. But I think a more interesting question, and one that I talk a lot about with my own students, is that there were a lot of questions that arose in the aftermath of our Civil War. And we never definitively resolved those questions. And I see a lot of the division politically that we and socially that we're experiencing now as a result of that. I think, historically speaking, civil wars can take a really, really long time for countries to emerge from. And it's not entirely clear on some occasions whether or not we really have effectively emerged from our one civil war with a clear sense of the federal government's role in protecting the civil rights of its citizens. And I think there's a lot to be said about sort of, thinking carefully about the lessons that we learned in the aftermath of that civil war, and thinking about what our political system should be doing, and the problems that it could be more effectively solving today.
Well, I do want to talk about how we might solve some of those problems today. While I have Civil War experts on, I'd like to learn a little bit for just a moment about the lead up to the American Civil War. Did it?
Sure.
It came after a divisive presidential election.
Sure.
Are there important parallels there or not?
Well, I think the thing to keep in mind is that, we sort of think that the outcome of the presidential election in 1860, elicited this immediate and spontaneous response that was secession. But really, this was, years and years in the making, and the arguments behind secession were rehearsed decades before it actually occurred, and there was great thought put into it. People like John C. Calhoun had been, and others had been sort of thinking about this and building the foundations for this argument for years and years, and there was coordination, and there was anticipation all built into that. moment. So yes, the outcome of the 1860 election was contested, and some would say that, you know, that the way it was run was unfair. But the response was anything but spontaneous. It was really quite orchestrated. So in that regard, when I look around today and I think, yes, we're emerging from an election whose outcome was contested, but I don't see the sort of coordinated and anticipation and that sort of preparation that went into that moment that occurred in 1860 and then continued into 1861.
Can I just add one thing on that? Mm-hmm. Judy's right. The 1860 division was years and years in the making. The one big difference is that you had a new party, a new political movement, the Republicans, that was born directly out of the slavery crisis, the expansion of slavery in particular, and it is the most successful, the most rapidly successful third party or new party movement in all of American history. And there is our model to kind of look back at. Do we have a politics now that would in some way divide us, break up the normal political system, the party system, to such an extent that it would create some kind of new coalition? And that's what it would have to be, a new coalition that then would win power and sufficiently frighten its opposition that might lead to some kind of breakup of the union in some form.
Well, David,
that's not
David, what's
easy
your...
to imagine, yeah. But that's probably what would have to occur.
Well, what's your answer today? Because we sure know the two major parties, especially the Republicans, do have splits in them. How
do
you...
They do.
How much does that worry you or not?
Well, it worries me a bit, but I'll tell you what worries me more is that we have a massive divide over many things, but right now, as we speak, let's take the tax bill. We have a massive divide between those who believe in government and those who don't. The current modern Republican Party really does not believe in governing. The only thing they are able to pass or have ever been truly interested in passing are tax breaks and tax cuts. They don't believe in many of the things that our taxes are supposed to actually do for us. On the other side, you've got a divided Democratic Party, too. It's got all kinds of factions, and it's almost always, by definition, a little bit at war with itself. But by and large, Democrats believe in a social contract. They actually believe in government or governing. They believe government owes people something and people owe government something. That division in our society is as old as this country, and it was in part what secession was about. Not exclusively. Secession was ultimately about slavery, but it was also about those who believe in government and those who don't.
David,
now, if this deepens any further in our society now, we could have a crisis that leads to some kind of at least political breakup, if not worse.
David Blight, history professor, Yale University. Judy Giesberg's a Civil War historian at Villanova. Judy, how important is President Trump's public hostility to the media?
Oh, that's a good question. I spend a lot of time thinking about how much I wish he knew something about history, because it's been...
We should give him a sabbatical and a two-month seminar,
And that would be great. Yeah, that'd be great. I mean, I think we could all get back to doing what we want to do is teach our students and talk about other stuff with our students. You know, I think, I guess like every other American, I'm concerned about, the attacks on the media and what that means for, Americans feeling about who they can trust and what are the news sources that they can trust. I don't see, this in my lifetime, certainly this is unprecedented, but I also sort of, as a historian, look for those moments in the past as well. I mean, I don't think we've always had a very politicized press, and that's certainly not something new to this time. But to have, I think what concerns me more about this president is just how the sort of very, very narrow sources of his information, that he really doesn't want any information that contradicts or that challenges what he's intended to do. And that is, that worries me more than anything, that just sort of, the fact that he that really only trusts one or two news sources. And I would, and like most Americans, I would question whether or not they should be called news sources. So that kind of thing, that bothers me a lot, right? I mean, who is he getting his information from? And that's, and the kind of power he can wield with having these this really negative relationship with what I think is, our reliable and respectable information sources of information.
You know, my next guest is a historian of how credible or incredible the American media have been. So we're going to have that conversation in just a moment. Before we go, I want to ask a question you raised. You talked about learning lessons and healing division. What would unify the country today from your point of view?
Well,
David, you might have to go first while she thinks about it for a while. It's
you know,
a tough
I think,
one.
I was thinking about that. I mean, throughout history, the moments when we've been most unified is when we faced a common enemy.
Mm-hmm.
These are not things you would anticipate or look forward to, but I suppose, right, if we identified, and I do think, I do like to think that in some ways Americans are, a good number of Americans who were divided before this election have, see those divisions as less consequential now than a big division between, what America stands for and what this current administration is trying to affect. So I think we, if people see this current administration as going down a road that is entirely un-American, that really is not, that really doesn't serve the purposes of this country, I think, that potentially that can unify certain factions of society. I think it is. I'm heartened to see the kind of political energy that has reigned in the last few months since Trump came into office. And I like to think that might, that might be hope for the future.
What about you, David? Hope
an
for the future?
Enemy in war. I'm sorry. A common enemy in war is clearly those times we've been most unified,
right,
even after 9/11. However, so does common suffering. And this we might think about, at least. The New Deal legislation, the great social network that came out of the New Deal, came out of the Depression, Social Security, the Wagner Act, and on and on and on and on. The idea of a social contract was born of enormous suffering. Now, I don't want this to happen, but if this current tax bill and current policies of the current leadership of Congress succeed in rolling back health care, rolling back voting rights, rolling back access to student loans, rolling back access to graduate school, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it could lead to a coalition of strange bedfellows who are all beneficiaries of that social contract, but don't like each other politically for a few other reasons. It may have to do with race or gay rights or guns or something else. So it's hard to say, and we are often creatures of how we react to events more than we even are of our ideologies.
Creatures of how we react. Judy, do you see hope in anything else beyond suffering?
Yeah, well, I do, and I mean, I think because I want to, right? I do think there was a growing chorus of voices that are opposed to the way in which this administration is seeking to dismantle so much of what I would say makes our civil society what it is today. I like to think that that even those who thought they saw something positive about voting the way they did last November, that more and more of them have to begin to see, without something, this sort of experience of common suffering. I like to think that at some point they'll wake up to this as well, and they'll join this chorus of voices of opposition.
We'll find out together. Judy Giesberg, Civil War historian at Villanova University. David Blight, history professor at Yale University.
Can't tell you about my hope. Huh?
What's that?
I just wanted to say I still have hope in something, too. But you know,
yeah?
I have hope in the natural rights tradition and the Bill of Rights. Our creeds are fine. We just have to live up to them.
Yeah, we do.
Keep the creeds and start acting on them. That's the tough part. Thanks to you both. It's good talking with you about this.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And in fact, we're tweeting out a link to a couple of articles that explored the same question. Is America on the brink of civil war? The New Yorker discussed this. Foreign Policy magazine discussed this with the guest you've just heard, among others. So we're tweeting out a link to that right now, at KUOW. And as promised, we're going to talk about how reliable the American press has actually been over our history. So stay tuned for that. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. If you've been listening for a bit, you just heard that Villanova professor talking about attacks on the media that make Americans wonder who they can trust. Fake news, right? We've all heard that phrase. One way the White House is attacking the press, and you have media organizations from CNN to the Washington Post pushing back and saying, wait, no, journalists hold powerful people accountable. We verify our reporting before publishing. Well, our next guest says, be careful who you rely on for truth, and historically, the media haven't always been so reliable. Archivist Kevin Young is the author of the new book, Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. Kevin, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks for having me.
You started writing this book 6 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think about these attacks on the media in the 2016 presidential campaign and up to today?
Well, I started with thinking about hoaxes historically and how in the 19th century they started with Barnum and people like that thinking about, in a way, some of the same questions as we have today about
P.T. Barnum?
Yeah, about how could America be great, you know, thinking about our connection to, in his case, George Washington and the founding fathers. And, you know, I trace it up to today and thinking about the ways that some of these same divides that I think the hoax makes use of are at play today and in our fake news. And one of them happens to be race, I think. But also, I think that the fake news really is part of this larger trend that I trace in the book of are hoaxes more frequent now and are they worse? And I think they are. And I think the past year or so has shown us the ways in which not only are there hoaxes being pushed out, but even our election last year had these effects of bots and things that played on these very same things of race and divide and sought to divide us further, I think.
I do want to talk about hoaxes and race. First, I was referring to the mainstream media.
Sure.
And are you also saying that even the news that we're used to thinking of as reliable is less reliable and always has been than we think?
No, I do think that technology affects the hoax and affects fakery, you know, and it can make it somewhat easier. But I also think that the internet and journalists catch hoaxes. You know, they're the way you saw that in the Washington Post story this week where someone was trying to fake against the Roy Moore story and you know, corrupt sort of the idea of sources.
This is the woman who went to the Washington Post claiming she had been
assaulted,
raped and then had an abortion and all about this candidate Roy Moore.
Yeah, I mean, and these were fake, and the journalists took, you know, did what journalists do, I think, and caught it. I don't think journalism, you know, I do trace fake journalist stories and specific fakery, but I really trace it to the people who did it. What's, I think, important to keep in mind is that journalists catch journalists, and the internet catches internet hoaxes, and I don't want to take a strong position and say that, hey, these people are to blame. I think it's more complicated than that. This is the media we've created, and in some ways we've bought and sometimes believe in, and I want to understand why.
What is it about the hoax that you think is a major theme in American life?
Well, you know, starting with Barnum, I think the hoax really did speak to these questions of what it meant to be an American, what it meant to be a person now. And, you know, Barnum, his first hoax was about George Washington. It was featured a black woman who he claimed was George Washington's nursemaid, which would have made her 161 years old, which he advertised. And then, you know, that wasn't true, of course, but people want to see her. You know, they wanted this connection to the founding father of our nation. And I think hoaxes became a way to understand what it meant to be a young nation. And then as we went...
What do you mean by that? How did hoaxes help us understand?
I know it's ironic, right, that a hoax would help you kind of establish your bona fides, or, you know, but that was very much what the hoax did. It, you know, like in England, people would find a Shakespeare play, which they made up, you know, as a way to say, hey, you know, Shakespeare is important. We're important. You know, this is a way of kind of honoring one's past and nation. And I think that Barnum...
You didn't have actual connections to the foundations of your civilization, but you could
make
sort of fake your way toward it.
Well, and also it's a way of saying Shakespeare is so important now that he's worthy of faking, right? We want more Shakespeare.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I think right now, some of the divisions that Barnum played with, later he showed a man, a black man, he called What Is It? In 1860, and this was just a year after Origin of the Species, but he promoted this figure as the missing link, you know, and so these hoaxes have long played on questions of race, but also questions of origin and where we come from and who are we. And
why? What does race have to do with the hoax?
Well, both of those figures were black.
Yeah.
You know?
Why do you think that? But you think that that's not a coincidence. So
no. I trace it all the way into sort of the fake Indians from the start of our republic, whether that was the Boston Tea Party till now, where you see there were some uncovered this last summer of people pretending to be Native American. I talk about Rachel Dolezal, who is a
Washington state's own.
Correct. And I think she's an interesting figure because just a week after she was uncovered.
Will you explain who she is for those who don't know?
She was a woman who was white by birth and pretended to be black and darkened her skin and changed her hair. And
she's in Spokane, an NAACP leader.
Yeah, yeah. Lucky you all, you know. Mm-hmm. she then was caught and, you know, outed, as it were. And then what was interesting is then, troubling, I'd say, a week later, the Charleston shooting happened. And in my book, I try to think about this connection between the two. What's it mean that they happen within a week of each other? And to me, both of those figures, the Charleston shooter and Dolezal, misunderstand blackness, you know, and they see in it trauma and pain. And one sort of seeks to sort of join it and promote it, and the other seeks to kind of eliminate it or see it as inflict more. And I tried to understand the way that this connection with race went all the way back to Barnum and, you know, preys on our deep divisions that I think, you know, your other guests were talking a little bit about the threats to these kind of very things that only seem to be increasing.
I imagine this this nursemaid who's supposed to be 160 years old, how long did she tour with this show?
Well, she toured till she died, actually, and she probably died of exposure. We think she was probably enslaved. We know she had been, but we think that Barnum had purchased her. It's a little muddy there. You know, and Barnum was clever. He would take her one place, which Providence, where she was, which was a free state, and, you know, he would really focus on her liberation, and then you take her somewhere else and sort of say, you know, who knows what where she's from and how she served. So he really played both aspects. And then when she died, he autopsied her in a medical theater and charged admission, which is just a troubling kind of end. But I think also thinks about the stakes, which are life and death for this kind of fakery.
And why is there something about racial attitudes in this country that play into a hoax like that?
Well, I almost think it's the other way around. I came to think by the end that race was a kind of hoax, that it too was a fake thing pretending to be real, which means it had real effects, you know? There's a lot of hoaxes built on race, but also race plays into a lot of hoaxes, you know, or plays off them. Sometimes in literal ways and sometimes in more elaborate ones, but always there's this returning to that. And I really sought to understand why. Why do we sort of believe the worst of each other, which is another sort of quality I think the hoax has gotten only worse at. You know, now, it used to be even in the stories I'm telling you of Barnum, they're at least kind of honorific. You know, it's like, hey, this who is this person? And they let viewers believe they could be an expert in something. You know, they could choose themselves. It was almost a democratic principle. And now I think there are no experts. We're in a time where experts are looked down on and they're seen as somehow a liability. Barnum at least faked doctors. Now we don't even bother that because, you know, it doesn't matter somehow. And I think that's the troubling state we're in.
I'm talking with Kevin Young, and he's the author of the book Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. And you, what should a listener do with this information now? You want us to be more wary, more savvy, and then what? What do we do?
Well, I think we have to be cautious, but not cynical. Because in a weird way, the cynicism, the belief that, say, everything is fake, is what's gotten us in this position. I'm someone who directs a library, the Schomburg Center in Harlem, part of the New York Public Library. And I think libraries are a great place to start. I mean, it sounds very basic, but in one way, they're the places that through the years, through the generations, and especially now, keep the records of our time. You know, they are the ones on the front lines thinking about information, what's good information, what sources are. And you can find lots of things, as I did working on this book, at the library and in archives. I also think we have to, you know, be a bit generous with each other and listen to each other rather than simply believe the worst about each other, which someone else is telling us about.
Yeah, that's a powerful hoax that makes you want to believe something about the other tribe that makes you feel better about yourself. Kevin Young, writer and archivist at the New York Library Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, and the new book is Bunk, and you can hear more from Kevin Young in person tonight at Benaroya Hall. Kevin, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Our show is put together today by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel. Tomorrow at noon, you know, it's KUOW's Week in Review. We're going to catch you up on the news you might have missed and what it all means with Erica C. Barnett and Joni Balter and our former mayor, Tim Burgess. I hope you'll join us for that tomorrow at noon on the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.